Welcome to the Compose Like a Girl podcast. I'm your founder, host, and composer, Jocelyn Hagen. My Compose Like a Girl initiative amplifies female-identifying composers, helps conductors diversify their concerts, and works toward more equality in music programming and commissioning. I've been sitting down for conversations with some amazing composers, and I want to invite you into these deeper explorations of art and life. I hope you leave with some inspiration, just as I did. On today's episode, I'm sharing a recent conversation I had with Sarah Kirkland Snyder. You'll notice that a common theme in this new podcast is the importance of seeing yourself in the people you admire. Representation. Sarah Kirkland Snyder was the first female composer that I identified with in a huge way. Not just because she was also young and blonde, but because she had succeeded in something that I was desperate to do, finding a way to skillfully incorporate elements of popular music into the craft of composition. Snyder herself stylistically describes her early work, quote, somewhere between early Debussy and Joni Mitchell, end quote. We're going to spend some time talking about Penelope, her orchestral song cycle based on Homer's Odyssey, because this was my first introduction to her music. So, heads up, listeners, before you play this episode, you might want to listen to her brilliant album, Penelope, from New Amsterdam Records, wherever you stream your music. We get pretty specific about some of the movements in this episode, so you might appreciate the conversation more if you've listened ahead of time. If you want to hear the full interview, become a supporter by joining our Compose Like a Girl initiative on Patreon. Thanks for tuning in, and enjoy. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Jocelyn. So nice to be chatting with you.
I'm so delighted that you were able to come on the podcast with me today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
I was introduced to your work in 2010 with your song cycle, Penelope, and I immediately fell in love with that piece. It's so fresh and original, and I love this review, genre erasing, which I really feel is true of that work. And it spoke to my sensibilities as both a singer-songwriter and a composer. Was composing this work and its subsequent recording a career-defining moment for you?
Yes, absolutely. Although I didn't know it quite at the time. I mean, to be quite honest, when I was writing Penelope, I had just graduated from graduate school at Yale like a year or maybe a year and a half prior, and I was feeling a bit disillusioned with classical music and the whole our whole scene, to be quite honest. And I got this wonderful offer from Ella McLaughlin, the playwright, to do music for a commission she had from the Getty Center to come up with a song cycle using the female characters of the Odyssey. But then she decided she wanted to turn it into a play with music for one woman herself. She's got a fantastic singing voice, but doesn't read music. And so we had a lot of talks about what the music would sound like. And she said, well, for one thing, I need to be able to learn it by ear. But for another, she said, this is about an everyday, every woman. And I think the kind of music that she would sing would have a lot of vernacular music influence, pop, folk, rock, whatever. And she knew that I had listened to all that kind of music growing up. We talked about music a lot. We've been friends for a few years. And she knew that I sometimes felt like I was repressing a lot of those influences when I was writing classical music. And so she said, you know, I want you to feel very comfortable to just explore all the influences that, you know, inspired you when you were writing music in high school. And then I started a record label, New Amsterdam Records, with a couple friends of mine. And the whole point, the whole ethos behind the record label was to create a home for music that was in between genres or that reached outside of classical lines in its, like organically in its musical design and thinking. And so these are my friends, Judd Greenstein and Bill Bertel, and we were sitting around having all these conversations about aesthetics, and they came to see Penelope, the play, and they were like, this is exactly the kind of music we should be releasing at New Amsterdam. And I was like, really? You know, this, it's so poppy. And they were like, are you hearing yourself? You know, like, you shouldn't be thinking in these genre lines or saying that it's not, you know, that it's to this or to that. Like, I was still so stuck in sort of, you know, the ingrained ways of thinking about genre. And I, yeah, caught myself sort of dismissing the music I'd written as not artistically worthy enough since it was so simple and had a lot of you know, patterns of four and eight bar phrases, which I've been taught was very taboo in grad school and, you know, not at all high art. And so anyway, but I, hearing myself talk and having these conversations with them, I realized that they were making a really good point. And I needed to put my, you know, my walk where my talk was, if I was really believing that composers should feel free to write whatever they wanted to write. And so we sort of challenged each other, and I decided to turn this into a song cycle and make a record of it.
I loved hearing about all of that because my experience in graduate school was so similar. Mm-hmm. You know, at St. Olaf, I felt very welcomed, and like anything I did was, yes, go for it and just see what you can do. And which I believe is how composition, especially for undergraduates, should be taught. Mm-hmm. And then I went to graduate school and yeah, I could not, I would have loved to have dived into those, to my singer-songwriter sensibilities and explore that. But I also definitely got that feedback that that was not okay. You know, mm-hmm. I felt like I had all these strikes against me, you know, which I'm sure is the same for you.
Yes. Yeah. And it's even harder, I think, to have those leanings as a woman in the field, especially, well, I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm 48 and I was 30 in grad school, and I was the only woman in my class at this time. So this was like 2003, and being the only woman in a classroom full of men, you really don't want to be the singer-songwriter, you know? It's like you really want to prove that you are, you know, right there writing this very intellectually complex and rigorous music, and that it's not about, you know, because the implication is that if you're not doing that, you're not capable of it somehow, and that you're supposed to represent the entirety of your gender. And it's, yeah, so it was, for me, the gender thing got tied up a lot with the aesthetics. And I felt like I needed to prove myself as a composer in ways that I think a lot of my male counterparts did not feel like they had to prove themselves. So that complicated things for me, and maybe it did for you as well. The thing that was really eye-opening, as well as I think career-defining, was how well-received Penelope was, which really could not have been more of a shock to me. It made me realize that the world outside of academia was much more open-minded than I'd given it credit for. And I think a lot of people wish that a lot of different kinds of music had a place in the world of classical music. And so that's what we're still trying to do at New Amsterdam today, is to keep a home for anybody who's willing to swing for the fences and write music that they think doesn't belong in classical music.
Well, I love that. And I love New Amsterdam Records. And I've been following you ever since you began. And yeah, I just love hearing what you guys put out. And you know, I feel like there's always been kind of a kinship between us, because your record label is so similar to the publishing company that my husband and I created.
Oh, really?
In the sense that it's not a nonprofit, but it sort of might as well be in a lot of different ways.
Sure.
We, you know, we give a huge royalty back to our composers, and
that's amazing.
Because we wanted to have a different model out there, different choices for composers.
Yes.
So I just love the idea that you saw a hole in the market and you decided to go after it with something that you were passionate about.
We saw a hole in the market and we went after it with passion. And I added in naivete, but.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think that's part of it too. Like mm-hmm. there are reasons why things were done a certain way for so long, but so you bump up against those problems in a new kind of different way and come up with different solutions.
Exactly.
At least I feel like that's what we did. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You see that you yourself, you know, we were saying, well, there's nobody that would put out our records right now. Like we can't just call up Cantaloupe and ask them to put out this record, or call up this other label or whatever. So we were like, we have to just do it ourselves. And I think that is how so many, you know, great ideas are born, is because you're like, I need this for myself. And you and your husband were probably thinking, we want to publish our music in a place where we can keep a lot of our royalties, because that rarely happens in classical music publishing. And so, you know, you're thinking empathically, but also, you know, you are the proxy for the party you're thinking about, and you're thinking about what your needs are, and you can relate to what other people need. And
my favorite movement of Penelope is Calypso. And it falls roughly in that 2/3 to 3/4 of the way through the piece, kind of in that golden ratio magic area. Do you consider that to be the climax?
Oh, interesting. You know, I sort of don't, strangely enough. I actually think of Baby Teeth and Bones and Bullets as the sort of, I think of that as this major, like everything is sort of leading up to this moment where she's sort of inside his head having his, feeling his emotions at this point in the story. And he sort of has this reckoning with God and then decides to try to fight back against himself and try to recover himself emotionally. But I can see why musically Calypso feels like that golden ratio, the climax, because it is sort of, it's the last big, it's a faster tempo, and it's sort of a, there's a lot of impassioned outcry in the music. And then it kind of grows more a bit in more inward after that. So I can see why you'd think that.
Yeah, it feels a bit like an anthem.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very, yeah, very anthemic. And honestly, that's like something that I have to resist. I have, my music gets very anthemic very easily and quickly, and I have to fight that temptation a lot of the time.
Let's listen to Calypso, the 10th movement of Penelope.
Thank you.
I really love hearing Shara Nova's voice on Penelope. Tell me more about how you got to know her.
Yeah, so I love this story because it speaks to the generosity of Shara's spirit, but I did not know her at all. I mean, I was very familiar with her singing in her recordings as My Brightest Diamond, and
yeah.
I was a big fan of hers, and I had read a lot of interviews with her, and she talked about studying opera I think at the undergrad and graduate level, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
But, so I just kept thinking when I was sort of transferring the music, arranging it for recording in my head and thinking who my ideal singer for this music would be. And I, found out that we had a mutual friend. And so I was able to get her email address. And I just emailed her out of the blue. I sent her some MIDI tracks, which, as you know, are so embarrassing.
yes.
You know, like MIDI mockups with this awful monotone singing of the computer. And I was sure that I would never hear back, but she wrote back very friendly, you know, short, but said, like, I'm really busy. I'm on tour right now. I don't know how much time I have, but I'll be in New York in a couple weeks if you want to meet up and we can talk about it. So we met up at a practice room in Midtown, and she sang through some of the songs at the piano, and I just almost passed out. I mean, it was so glorious hearing her sing this music. And I should mention, she also recorded herself singing over the MIDI and sent them back to me, one of which we actually wound up using on the final recording. Her recording of Dead Friend was so haunting and gorgeous, the one she had sung on her home microphone to over the MIDI. That we wound up keeping that. But Shara just has this attitude, this wonderful attitude of, she likes to say yes to the universe and hopes that it says yes back, as she puts it. Mm-hmm. And she had a lot of the same aesthetic conflicts internally that I had, which I had alluded to earlier in our conversation coming out of grad school. She had them from different perspectives, you know, having been more, grown up more in the rock, come of age, her career more in the rock side of things. She felt like she needed to prove herself in this other way. It was wonderful because that really fed into the way that we recorded the CD. I mean, I think our immediate closeness and bond, we stayed up all night talking, like the first night that we started working on the recording. It was just this really wonderful, magical experience, which has then sort of turned itself into many years of collaboration and friendship, which I'm extremely grateful for.
I love that. And I feel like, and this might sound silly, but I feel like you can hear that. I feel like there's a connection there that shines through in the performance that I hear in the recording.
Nice. Yeah, I think that stuff really does matter. I mean, it's the emotions that you're drawing upon, right? So if a singer knows where they're coming from emotionally, but also where you are coming from as a composer emotionally and in terms of your influences and your orientation towards music and the values you want to see in the music, reflected in the music, then, I mean, the more communication you can have with your singer, the better a performance you're going to have, the more convincing, I think, musically, because the performer and the composer really need to be exactly on the same page for a great performance, for it to really feel authentic.
Yeah. Well, and I think something that I've learned too is that the more honest I am with myself and with mm-hmm. my art and what I'm creating, that actually that's what connects with people even more.
Yes.
Like if I'm
It's so true.
If there's any kind of not that I think I ever write insincerely, but if there's ever something that just is like it doesn't quite feel like me, or there's a struggle happening somewhere in the composition of it, then I think this isn't right, and this isn't what is going to really connect with people, because I think audiences like they're drawn to that honesty and that that there was an expectation there that didn't end up showing up. You know, it wasn't.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. It's so true. And I think being honest as a composer, it's hard too, because you have to make yourself vulnerable when you do that. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of like showing somebody your diary or what you look like undressed. You know, you're laying your emotions a lot more bare than if you are writing music that's based on like a crossword puzzle and mathy systems and all of that. You know, you don't make yourself as vulnerable when you write that kind of music. So I think that's the other difficult thing about writing emotionally direct music is you constantly feel exposed and you have to be okay with that.
Well, I definitely want to start talking about your latest masterwork, Mass for the Endangered. It was commissioned by Trinity Wall Street and features a libretto by Nathaniel Bellows. And you can listen to this entire work on YouTube featuring the English vocal ensemble Gallicantus, conducted by Gabriel Crouch, with stunning animations by Deborah Johnson, also known as Candy Stations. Snyder explains, quote, "The origin of the Mass is rooted in humanity's concern for itself, expressed through worship of the divine, which, in the Catholic tradition, is a God in the image of man. Nathaniel and I thought it would be interesting to take the Mass's musical modes of spiritual contemplation and apply them to concern for non-human life, animals, plants, and the environment. There is an appeal to a higher power for mercy, forgiveness, and intervention. But that appeal is directed not to God, but rather to nature itself." This is just an incredible work in so many ways. And I love the subject matter of it. I think it was a beautiful way to reimagine the Mass. And I know that that was kind of the heart of what the commission was about. And the line that I wrote down when I was listening to it again today was actually from the Credo. "We believe in all who are silenced." Mm-hmm. And I just thought how meaningful that statement is in so many ways. And
yes,
especially
oh my gosh, yeah.
Animals, you know, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, Nathaniel is an incredible, incredible poet. I just adore his writing, and it's always very deep and layered and elegant and subtle. It's a composer's dream to set. He knows how to write text that sounds beautiful sung as well. And there's sort of an old Victorian quality to it. I have to give Nathaniel credit for the idea for this Mass. I mean, when Trinity came to me and they said they wanted me to write a Mass on whatever I want and that I could reimagine it as long as I used, you know, two Latin movements, the Sanctus Benedictus and the Gloria. And I knew before I went to Nathaniel that he was going to say he wanted to do something on the environment because it's something he's very passionate about. And it's something that he and I have spent a lot of time talking about too. And we'd written a song cycle called Unremembered about childhood memories in the outdoors. And, for both of us, we get a lot of inspiration from walking outside in the woods and animals, and we talk about that a lot. So, but sure enough, I went to him and I said, "What do you want to write on?" And he said, "Endangered animals." And I was like, mm-hmm. Okay, amazing, fantastic. And then almost the next day, I mean, he is so fast. He's always so inspired. He sent me these beautiful poems inspired by the different, you know, movements and meanings, the meanings of the different movements of the Catholic Mass. The meaning and function of the original Catholic Mass and sort of reconceived from a secular environmental perspective. And I was so moved, and it was very easy to write the music for this piece for me. I wrote it much faster than I normally write music. And that's just a testament to how much I relate to his language and his poetry and his ideas.
And now let's take a moment to listen to the Credo from Mass for the Endangered.
Thank you.
Well, it's just beautiful, unabashedly beautiful, I think. And I hope that it gets programmed a lot in the choral world, because I think it will speak to so many people. And, you know, going through the score, which I loved that I could listen to the whole thing and see all the music online on the publisher's website.
Yeah.
The vocal writing is very idiomatic. There's very little divisi, you know, so a lot of choirs could tackle this work, I think, and do a beautiful job with it.
Oh, thank you. That's so appreciated. Thank you.
The thing that I thought I should probably touch on even just a little bit is your New Music Box article from 2017 about women composers and gender relationships in classical music and how we are perceived. And I guess I wanted to touch base on it to see if you think that most of that is still resonating strongly, or if some things feel different now that we're in this new territory of even more gender fluidity, you know? I'm just curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, gosh, you know, I wrote that article in 2017. It's 5 years ago, and it does feel like we've already changed a lot. I mean, when I wrote that, women were barely being performed by orchestras. And there was just an article in the New York Times the other day saying that, you know, women and BIPOC composers are being programmed so much more. And I mean, that's a huge change. And I think across the board, not just orchestras, but chamber ensembles, choirs, you know, we're seeing a lot more diversity in programming, and we're seeing more efforts by academic institutions to hire women and non-white composers. And I think that attitudes are certainly shifting. And I think there's been a lot of sharing of perspective on social media, which has been, I mean, everybody loves to hate social media, and myself included, but I think there's been a lot of one blessing of social media has been this sharing of personal essays, you know, or even just short, you know, a few paragraphs about somebody's experience or perspective has created, I think, more empathy in our community about what it's like to feel otherized as a composer, to feel like you don't belong in this scene or this community. And there's more sensitivity to that, I think, across the board. All those changes are fantastic and enormous and wonderful. That said, I still get asked, you know, people will come up to me after this happened to me just the other day after I had a performance by the New York Philharmonic. And this gentleman came up afterwards and said, "Did you orchestrate that all by yourself?" And I mean, you know, you're always going to encounter like points of view that are frustratingly ignorant or sexist or whatever. And often it's not born of ill will. It's just a bit of ignorance. And you sort of have to grin and bear it. But I think what I was trying to address more with that article were the sort of systemic ways that we talk about gender in music that we weren't even really aware of. And I think we are more aware now of how we talk about music. But, you know, we just have such a long way to go. The fact that we still barely know the music of female composers, you know, before our time just says so much. I mean, I've got, my kids are both studying piano, and they have, neither one of them yet has come home with a piece by a female composer. And I know that their teachers are forward thinking, but it's the fact that their teachers don't know pieces by female composers, and it would take them a lot of time to go research and, you know, listen, or maybe it seems like more time than they have or whatever. You know, it just takes so long to move the dial. And I don't think we really will move the dial until we're in a place where pieces by female composers are taught at the, you know, elementary school level, you know, and kids grow up seeing, and not just female composers, but non-white composers, you know, composers of color. Until kids grow up knowing about all different kinds of composers from different backgrounds, like nothing really is going to change in a way that it needs to. So I think we're probably several hundred years out from that, unfortunately, maybe just like 100 years out. But I'm hopeful that eventually we will unearth this massive catalog of amazing music by women that will be played all the time, you know, on the radio or by kids learning piano and clarinet and oboe or at the orchestra or whatever. And I think then it will, things will feel more genuinely equal.
I'm so grateful that you took some time to do this with me tonight.
Of course, my pleasure. Yeah, anytime.
Both Sarah and I didn't have the greatest experiences in graduate school, and I believe it was due to the fact that many of our teachers didn't see themselves in us. They didn't know how to relate. They didn't expect us to go far. I know that for me, I'm most interested in mentoring and helping other women composers because I see myself in them. I don't want them to have to go through what I went through. I want to help them find their voices and make connections and improve their craft, because it was that kind of guidance that I so desperately wanted and needed. I want them to know that they are not alone in this endeavor. Our full potential is far from being tapped. Compose Like a Girl was produced by Justin Schell, Laura Kreider, and me, Jocelyn Hagen, with special help from fellow female composers Erica Malpass and Addie Struckman. The Compose Like a Girl theme music was composed by cellist Cicely Parnas. Thank you all for helping me with this vision. Thanks also to New Amsterdam Records and Nonesuch Records for the use of Sarah's music. You can learn more about Sarah Kirkland Snyder and her music at sarahkirklandsnyder.com and by following her on Instagram. Check out the links in our show notes, visit jocelynhagen.com/composelikeagirl, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram to listen to the music we talked about today. Learn more about the Compose Like a Girl initiative and check out past episodes. You can also find choral programming ideas by checking out the Compose Like a Girl choral series distributed through Graphite Publishing. To ensure that we can keep bringing these conversations to you, please consider joining our Compose Like a Girl Patreon page and giving what you can. Subscribe to the Compose Like a Girl podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're so moved, rate us on Apple Podcasts and share it with a few friends who you think will find inspiration. Until next time, trust your instincts. Be brave and unapologetic for your talents. Thanks for listening.